We've been looking at some things relative to the premillennial theory. Tonight, we're looking at a couple, actually. It's one of these things where there's not near enough for one, and then you wonder about if there's too much for two, but we'll see how we do. You might turn to Revelation chapter 16. We're looking at Armageddon and the millennium. Now, you're going to hear that a lot from folks who are of premillennial persuasion. And what we'll do, we'll look at the places where you find this. And one of those is Revelation chapter 16 and verse 16. It's when the fifth bowl or vial, however your translation reads, is read or is said, is opened, excuse me. And then it says in verse 16, Revelation 16:16, they gathered them together to the place called in Hebrew Armageddon. Now that might be sometimes spelled with an H in front of the A. Sometimes it might say Mount Megiddo, or it might be something like that in your footnotes. That's it. As far as Armageddon goes, that's the mention of it right there. Now the millennium, which is of course the thousand-year reign, you find that there's a little more about that. It's in Revelation chapter 20, starting in verse 2 down through verse 7. We can pick up verse 1 as well. I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottom of the pit, a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more till 1,000 years were finished. But after these things he must be released for a little while. I saw thrones and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. Then I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. There you go. Now, it's not the end of it. It goes on in verse 5 that the rest of the dead did not live again until 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection. Over such, the second death has no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. At some time or another, we've probably heard about not the hill of Megiddo, but we've heard about the battle of Armageddon and the millennium. As a matter of fact, there's so much that's said about these two events that you would think that they're on almost every page in Revelation, and if not in Revelation, maybe in all the Bible. It's all you see. And so on. There's a preacher on the television, on cable, thumbing through things to see what might be on today that might interest me. I found something on the History Channel finally. I did run across this one particular individual, and I could almost guarantee that if you were to watch him, well, at any time, not just tonight, he'd be talking about either the thousand-year reign or the Battle of Armageddon. And it's as though that's all there is, you know, into the Scriptures. But these passages right there, that's it. And it may cause one to wonder and maybe then investigate. How is it that so much comes out so little? I really don't know. But that happens a lot, not just in religious matters, but in a lot of things. Sometimes I've always been amazed at what archaeologists, paleontologists, and so on, they're out here looking for fossils. They'll find a jawbone no bigger than this right here, and by the time they're done, they've reconstructed the entire animal. And it doesn't matter, you know, how big the animal is or whatever. It's amazing, you know, that you get so much out of so little. But then that's kind of what happens. Now, the first thing we're looking at then is Armageddon, or in particular, the Battle of Armageddon. Now, the premillennialists will tell us that this is the battle, it's the final battle of all battles. It's the end of the line. This is it right here. The great forces of Satan's armies are said to engage in battle with God's army. Now, we're talking about real armies here, not just spiritual armies, not spiritual battle, real. They believe all these things are to be taken literally. We're talking about all this being real. It's a real place, it's a real battle, and so on and so on. Now, for years, the main contingency of Satan's army, up until just a few, a couple decades ago, it was the Soviet Union and their allies. I mean, you used to hear that all the time. Well, I wonder who it is now that would have this great, massive army. Someone might say, well, militant Islamists, is that right? And they fit in there. Well, why not go with that? People have gone with different things before. In this history of this country and religious people, when the Civil War took place, the people in the South thought that the Northern Army was Satan's army. And the people in the North thought that the Southern Army was Satan's army. And it all proved out it wasn't. It wasn't Armageddon or anything like that. But people have been making wrong assignments for a number of years. God's army is usually said to be Christians and the righteous survivors of the tribulation. We talked about the tribulation two or three weeks ago. It's those who survived the tribulation, and then the others are those who are raptured and brought back with Jesus, and then it's when this battle happens. But in all of this, the one thing that it seems to me, right off the bat, I mean, now this is where I think it just goes a little bit off the rails. They're talking about this being a real battle, a real fight now, a real war taking place. And I think to myself, that being literal and all that, what about 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 4? That the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds. Well, now, according to this theory, the weapons of our warfare are going to be, they're going to be real weapons. But the Bible tells us in 2 Corinthians 10, well, they're not. Well, when does the change come about? You see, where do we get all this? And where do the word about the army and everything else and all this developing? Now, what happens sometimes, and we'll get to this in a moment, there are some events that you read in Revelation 19 that are kind of brought over and associated with this conflict. And we'll look at that in just a little bit. As a matter of fact, Timothy calls Jesus King of Kings, Lord of Lords, the only potentate, things like that. And in Revelation chapter 19 and verses 11 through 16, you read these and you find out, well, now this is Jesus coming forth to do battle. I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on him was called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he judges and makes war. His eyes were like a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns. He had a name written that no one knew except himself. He was clothed with a robe dripped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. Right away, you can make an association then with Jesus by the time you get to verse 13. The armies in heaven, clothed in white, in fine linen, white and clean, followed him on white horses. Out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, that with it he should strike the nations, and he himself will rule with a rod of iron. Both things that were said back in the letters to the seven churches. And he himself treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of Almighty God. And he has on his robe and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. I don't think there's anybody who says that this isn't Jesus. But now what he's doing, and everything associated with this, well, there's some difference of views on all that. But the idea here is that he comes forth to do battle. Now, is it a physical battle or is it a spiritual battle? And it's going to be one or the other. But now, we've kind of set up the idea that it's going to be, Satan's army versus God's army. And here's the leader of God's army. It's going to be Satan. Jesus, excuse me. I don't know who the leader of the Satan's army is supposed to be. I suppose Satan or whatever. But anyway, at this point in the Revelation letter, we're prepared to witness great struggle. That's the whole idea. There's struggle in the letter. Now, I have always viewed Revelation, well, I haven't always viewed it, but for the last 20 years, I guess, I've viewed Revelation as being a message of victory. Judgment and victory. And you go through it, and when you look at these things, and if you got that in your mind, and don't get carried away with something, and you look at it, well, that's what fits in there. Well, there's a scene at the great white throne. What's it all about? Judgment and victory. Well, there's all these openings, all these bowls, and there's the trumpets and everything. What is it all about? It's about judgment and victory. Here comes this conflict. What's it about? It's about judgment and victory all the way through. That's what it's all about. And it's a reminder to the people to whom this letter was written that, yeah, there might be, you know, some hard times. And yet this letter is telling them that there will be judgment and that there will be victory. And it's supposed to give them encouragement. And it's written, and this is called apocalyptic language, which means it's kind of a hidden message. And this isn't really something that's new. There's apocalyptic language back in the Old Testament. A lot of it in the book of Ezekiel. There's even some of it in the New Testament. I think some of that kind of language is used on the day of Pentecost, when it talks about the sun and the moon and turning to blood and the stars and everything, and the complete upheaval. It's apocalyptic language. It's got a hidden message. What's the hidden message? The world's going to be turned upside down. Why is the world going to be turned upside down? Because the gospel's being preached. There's things that are changing. I think there's apocalyptic language in Matthew chapter 24 when God comes to judge Israel and Israel is destroyed. A lot of things in there should be taken and understand that there's symbolic language. There's symbolic language also in Revelation. For example, there are several times when John said that he heard something. And it was as, what was it he says one time? As a mighty rushing wind. A mighty rushing river. Well, was it a river? No, he said it was like that. It was as. Another, as mighty trumpets. Well, was it really trumpets? No, it was like that. He's trying to describe things in language for us. But really, it's an idea. It's not really exactly that. It's not really a river. It's not really, you know, trumpets. It's like that, and that stands for something else. So you see that. Now, in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 13, it talks about the power of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. I'm not going to go over there and read all those, but that's what it talks about. So there's one side of this. And then there's also now a striking description of the strength of the King of Kings. Christ is pictured here as being on a white horse coming to judge and to make war. The devil gathers his army to fight in a place called, in the Hebrew tongue, Armageddon. That's what it says. If you have a booklet, there's a mistake there. It should say Revelation 16:16. And that's where it takes place. Now, what we need to do is take a look at this place. And I think when we take a look at this, we're going to see it's not a real place. It's close to a real place. And what it signifies and everything. But people are making too much out of it. Here's what we need to do. We need to realize that the battle of the great day is described. If you're still in Revelation chapter 19, we're going to look there. If you're not, you know, turn over there for just a moment or two. The battle of that great day is described right where we left off a few minutes ago. Starts in verse 17, down to verse 21. I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried with a loud voice, saying to all the birds that fly in the midst of heaven, come and gather together for the supper of the great King, great God, that you may eat the flesh of kings, the flesh of captains, the flesh of mighty men, the flesh of horses and of those who sit on them, and the flesh of all people, free and slave, both small and great. And I saw the beast, the kings of the earth and their armies, gathered together to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. Then the beast was captured, and with him the false prophet who worked signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two were cast alive into the lake of fire, burning with brimstone. I think we all understand what that means. And the rest were killed with the sword which proceeded from the mouth of him who sat on the horse, and all the birds were filled with their flesh. Well, what's happening here? Well, the battle takes place. And what is it? Well, again, you know, it's judgment and victory. There's judgment. These are the foes. And now the judgment's coming on the foes. And in the end, there's what? There's victory. And the main ones here that have been behind all this kind of thing with the false prophet and the beast, they're not only taken captive, but they're dispatched. If they're gone into the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, that's the end of them for all time. Now, while the Battle of Armageddon, you know, that's said to be the battleground, you know, Armageddon, that's where all this takes place. What you read in chapter 19, that's where all this takes place. All right, and they say that it's a real place. The problem is, there is no such battleground. There is really no hill or mount of Megiddo. There is no real Armageddon, a real place, you know, where you could go over there and somewhere get up on a high place and you could look out and say, right there, that's Armageddon is right. It's not there. It doesn't exist. Now, there are some things that are mentioned that do exist, and they kind of coincide with what's going on. But now here's the thing. Go back to Revelation chapter 16. If we're going to make this a real battle, a literal battle, that all these things are literal now, that's what we're told, literal 1,000 years, literal battle with all these armies, it's all literal, it's all real. Okay. Then here's what we've got in chapter 16 and verse 13. I saw three unclean spirits like frogs coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. Were they really frogs? They're kind of the leaders, the generals who fight for the devil, fight for Satan. And they're going to look like frogs? Is that it? Oh, well, now all of a sudden we'll come out. Well, no, they're like frogs. Yep. Okay. Well, now, how much of this are we going to take as literal, and how much is going to be, well, like or similar or, you know, figurative language? How's all that going to work? How do you determine all this, say? Well, they determine it by going down through there and they pick and choose and other things, you know, along that line. In Revelation chapter 9, here's another one. This also is said to be wait a minute now. Get back here. Okay. This also is said to be attached to the battle. And in verse 16 it says, the number of the army of the horsemen were 200 million. I heard the number of them. What it says there? 200 million. I don't think that there's ever been an army of any country that had 200 million horsemen. That'd be a lot of them. I don't think that there's any army today that's got 200 million horsemen. Come to think of it, we don't use horses in battle anymore. They did back when this was written. Used horses. Probably a lot of horses. And as things transition, now, at least in our military, we used to have what was called the cavalry. And those were the soldiers that were mounted on horses. But things changed, didn't they? And there wasn't a need for horses anymore. But now here's the interesting thing about the military. Sometimes they just don't want to let go of anything, you know. They kind of keep hang on to it forever and a day. My dad told me one time that when he was drafted, or when he enlisted in the Army, but when they got ready to send him overseas, they were going to hand him out rations, you know, that the soldiers would have with them, that if they, you know, got stuck in a tight place, they'd have something to eat. Sound like a pretty good deal. And my dad said, you know what they gave us? He said, they gave us rations left over from World War I. Wouldn't that be exciting to break open a can of that stuff? They did get some newer ones, but that's what they did. The Army doesn't want to let go of anything. So now what about this? You know, we got the cavalry division. And we're kind of phasing out horses. You know what they're phasing out horses with? Mobile equipment. One of the things that was big in the cavalry was, you know, all the trucks that had supplies and things like that. Tanks. Tanks are in a cavalry unit. No horses anymore. This has all changed. Now, I understand that maybe over in the Middle East, there may be some folks that are running around on horses, donkeys, camels, who knows what. But again, 200 million. And if you could see the place where all this is going to occur, you know, at best it's the Valley of Jezreel. 200 million just from one army. If they were all in there, they would be in there so tight that they couldn't move, let alone fight. But see, that's just, well, we'll just forget all that, you know, and something else. Here's another one. Revelation chapter 14 and verse 20. The winepress was trampled outside the city, and blood came out of the winepress up to the horses' bridles for 1,600 furlongs. That's 200 miles. The blood runs for 200 miles. Now, up to the horses' bridles. That's what it says there. Now, of course, it would depend on the horse, but, you know, it might be about like that, let's say. About eye level for me. Might be a little more. That horse down in the Amish country, I mean, that thing's taller than, I don't know, the biggest horse I ever saw. That bridle on that thing would be up here. But, you know, average horse, about like that. For 200 miles. That'd be a lot of blood, wouldn't it? A lot. And so, you know, you see things and you begin to understand, well, it's not all literal. I don't think that we can say that it's all literal because of what we see in here. Now, Armageddon means the hill of Megiddo. It's supposed to be in the valley of Jezreel. And if Megiddo's anywhere, it's in the valley of Jezreel. What is associated with Megiddo is not a hill, it's a plain. You know, a plain's kind of a level place, not a hill or a mountain or anything like that. The Valley of Jezreel was a real place, and it was where a lot of important battles for Israel in the Old Testament took place. For example, it's where Barak and Deborah overthrew the kings of Canaan in Judges chapter 5, verse 19. In the Valley of Jezreel, Gideon defeated the Midianites. You remember that, how they went out there and they had their torches covered with pitchers and they broke them and what all happened as a result of that. Saul, that would be King Saul, was defeated by the Philistines in 1 Samuel chapter 31, verse 8, in the Valley of Jezreel. Now also, there's Ahaziah died from Jehu's arrows in 2 Kings chapter 9 and verse 27. Also in the Valley of Jezreel, Pharaoh Necho overthrew Josiah. 2 Kings chapter 23, verse 29-30. So there's been a lot of fighting going on in the Valley of Jezreel, and some were important battles. All of these were important. This was not just some little thing when all these things happened, whether it was favorable or unfavorable. You know, these were important battles. And so you think, well, there'll be an important battle there. Is the battle important because it was in the Valley of Jezreel? Does that mean the Valley of Jezreel was important? Well, there'd be that association with it, is the idea. So here we've got what is judgment and victory. And it's going to take over, you know, it's going to be, you might think, like that very famous place where there were victories and some judgments. I think it stands as a, actually, as it doesn't have a verifiable place. I think it stands like a symbol of something. And somewhat like Waterloo. Now, everybody, I hope, is familiar with the Battle of Waterloo. That's where Napoleon was defeated and was never a threat to Europe again. He had ambitions of being the emperor of all of Europe, and he did a pretty good job getting so far with that. But finally, he was defeated at the Battle of Waterloo. Now, the interesting thing is, the word Waterloo has become associated, at least in our culture, with a failure, you know, or a defeat. It may be, you know, somebody might be trying to do something, like in baseball, a runner's trying to stretch a single into a double. Well, he doesn't make it. He slides in there, and they tag him out. An announcer might say, "Well, he met his Waterloo there, didn't he? Was it really Waterloo? No, no, it's figure speech." Or Martha's got this toaster, let's say, and she goes over there one day to put a couple slices of toast in, pushes the button, toast goes down, there it is, and 30 seconds later she looks over there and there's flame coming out of the, and she might say, "Well, I believe the toaster's met its Waterloo." We use the expression like that, you see. And so I think the idea of Armageddon is used in a sense like that. It signifies that Rome was, ultimately, it was a triumph of good over evil. And the persecuting Roman Empire that these folks had to live with, that it was going to fall, the false emperor worship would cease, and the Battle of Armageddon would be over. And the beast and the false prophet then would be taken. You know, it looked like for a while, I'm sure to some Christians, that Rome and its false emperor worship was going to prevail. You know, they were up against the odds, and it just didn't look like, you know, Christianity was going to stand. But the message here is that God would prevail. I think that's kind of interesting, you know, when we think about some of the things that have been going on, like what we were talking about in the lesson this morning. Now, we move on to the millennium. This is easier, a little easier. The term actually does mean 1,000 years. It means that. And you see it several places in there where there's 1,000 years that are mentioned. But now, while it mentions this in Revelation chapter 20, there are some things now that are not in there with the 1,000-year reign. Not mentioned at all. For example, there's no mention of the second coming of Christ. There's no mention there of a bodily resurrection. Now, it talks about a resurrection, but not a bodily resurrection. There's no mention of, you know, Christ being on earth. And there's no mention of Jerusalem or Palestine or Israel. There's none of those things in there. But when you get to the theory of premillennialism, they start talking about the 1,000 years, you got all them things in there. And talking about all that a lot. But now, there's no mention of it. Now, can we know when this 1,000-year period will be? I guess that's the real question. Now, last week, we studied about Christ's reign and how he's reigning on the throne now, on David's throne. That was from Acts chapter 2, verses 29 through 36. I'm not going to read them over again, but it says there when he ascended to heaven, he sat down at the throne. It would be David's throne that he was sitting on. Now, the key to this period, though, is actually he's reigning. There's a reigning with Jesus. And the key to knowing when this is for the binding of Satan. I think that clears everything up. The binding of Satan happens when the 1,000-year reign is in place. Now, I've said several times, and we even looked at this once, that the 1,000-year reign begins at the time of Jesus, His death and His resurrection. Again, it's victory. It even says in Hebrews chapter 2, you can see the passages here. There's the binding of Satan that's mentioned in verse 2 in Revelation chapter 20. But when Jesus rose from the grave, He bound Satan by limiting his power. You see this. You see in Matthew chapter 12, verses 28 and 29, that there's going to come a binding of the strong man. You can't go in and spoil his house unless you first bind the strong man. You've got to limit him to what he's able to do. The Hebrew writer says in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 14 and 15, that Jesus was victorious. He was victorious over what? Over death and over him who had the power of death. That would, of course, be Satan. Now, through Christ, we know, here's what we can do. We can now resist and be delivered. 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 8 and 9. Let's go over there and look at those real quick. Now, this is talking about what you can do now. You could do it in the first century. You can do it now because the 1,000 years began on the day of Pentecost and then with Christ's ascension, a little bit before the day of Pentecost, mentioned on the day of Pentecost. It continues until the time that Christ will return. Some of us say, well, that's been almost 2,000 years. That's right, because it's not a literal 1,000 years. Again, it's a figure of speech like other things in Revelation. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8. Be sober, be diligent, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. You know, that passage is used a lot, quoted like that. And I guess it's supposed to put a certain amount of fear in the person that hears it or reads it. And it should. That would be a good thing. Nothing wrong with that. But that's not all of it, is it? Well, look what it says in verse 9. Resist him. Steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. You're not just experiencing this on your own. There are others that are experiencing maybe not the very same thing, but things similar to this. So you're not on your own out there. Don't think it's just poor old me. Don't think that. But then he also says in there, resist him. We wouldn't be able to resist him unless he's limited in some way. But now also in James chapter 4, I always like what it says, James chapter 4, 7 through 10. I've got a sermon on that. But anyway, therefore submit to God. Now watch, resist the devil and he will what? Defeat you. No, it says he will flee from you. Well, he does that why? Well, because you got the upper hand. If you'll resist the devil. Jesus has bound Satan, and while he still may be doing some things, he's limited, and you can have the upper hand if you submit yourself to God and resist him. You know what? You'll be victorious. You'll come out on top. Now, I get weary sometimes listening to folks out there in the religious world that are Calvinists, and sometimes brethren who are Calvinists, go on and on and on about how we're just absolutely powerless. We can't do anything about it. That Satan is all-powerful. Satan's almost equal in power to Jesus or to God. Take your pick, either one. Equal to both of them. Doesn't matter. And I always think to myself, you know what? If there's God here in His power and there's Satan in His power, you know what? If they're equal, the best you could hope for would be a tie. Because one, if the power is equal, the one can't get ahead of the other. The best you can hope for is a tie. Yet we see over and over and over again how that God has defeated Satan, which means his power is greater, and that Jesus has defeated Satan and the death that Satan brings, which means he's greater. And then we're told if we submit to God, we can resist the devil and he'll flee. He'll give up on us. He'll leave because of defeat. Remember when Jesus was tempted by the devil in the wilderness? When it was over with, Jesus met every temptation. What did the devil do? He left. I didn't mean he went away and never returned, but he left, didn't he? Now, if we resist the devil, he'll flee from us. So he's limited in what he's able to do. So the strong man, or Satan, in Revelation chapter 20, verse 2, he's been bound. Now, this doesn't mean that sin came to an end. The bondage of sin may have been broken, and men now make the choice of whom they will serve. I like Revelation chapter 6. I've liked it ever since I first found it. Where it says in there, you know, you choose whom you will serve. Obedience unto life, or you can give yourself over to bondage unto death. Whichever it is. But now you can make the choice on this. You are not powerless to do that. And the way that you are able to do that is because of God's power and obedience to the gospel of Christ. Satan might be limited, but he's not eliminated. And there's a difference to that. He's kind of restricted. You know, now this is my illustration. This is the best I can do on this. Everybody knows that sometimes there are some dogs that are just a real problem. And somebody may have a dog running loose, and, you know, it'll just try to eat up whatever there is. I mean, he'll even go out there. I watched a neighbor of ours. I don't know what kind of dog it was. They had a black dog, and they had another one. And the one, the black dog, every once in a while, would run out there in the road and chase this truck that went by and be out there biting at the truck's tires. I always thought to myself, well, one of these days you're going to catch that truck, then what are you going to do with it? Well, the dog didn't have another step to the plan. But just do that kind of thing. And then the man that lived over there was an elderly gentleman. He had a beard down to about here. No hair up here. You get the picture. And one day his daughter came over and said, would you mind mowing the yard over there? I said, fine. I was over there mowing the yard. They told me that the dogs would be in the house. Good. Because I'd been just walking past there. And they came out there like they were going to eat me alive. Well, I mowed the yard. And when I was done, I went around the back and there was a broom out there. I thought I'd sweep the sidewalk off. Well, I didn't know. As soon as the mower got shut off, the old man turned the dogs loose. I walk around to the back. Guess what's meeting me coming down the steps? Both of them. They sure looked hungry to me. And it sounded like they meant business. So we had a tussle out there, me and the broomstick and those dogs and one thing or another. And I got out in the street and I finally got away from them. Now, one of them, I think it was the black one, bit me a couple of times. No harm. I didn't mow the grass anymore over there. But you know what? Eventually, they had so many problems with those dogs. They had to tie them up. Had to put them on chain. Okay? On that chain, they could still do a lot of harm if you got close enough. But they'd been limited with the damage they could do, hadn't they? By putting them on chain. So Satan is bound. He's on a chain. And like those dogs, he's limited. He can do so much, but he's not like he was before. And so those who are living and reigning with Christ for 1,000 years can be victorious as a result of this. Look at verse 6 there in Revelation chapter 20. Here's what you find in here, and I think I've always thought this was kind of was very interesting here. It talks about the first resurrection. I've thought about that and thought about that, and finally one day, it dawned on me that someone who's a Christian is going to have 2 resurrections. That's right. Now, the second one is yet to come. That is, unless you live until the time that Jesus returns. But the first resurrection, everybody's going to have a part in that. That would be baptism. And I don't think that's that far-fetched, is it? Because in Romans chapter 6, verses 3 through 5, it talks about being baptized into his death, being baptized into his resurrection. Raised up to walk in newness of life. A picture of a resurrection. So I think that's probably what the first resurrection is. It refers to baptism. And those who are in Christ, those who have been baptized into Christ, in Revelation chapter 20, And verse 6, the second death has no power over these ones. Well, it says in Romans chapter 8, verse 1, that there's no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. So there's no effect of that over them. They're not going to experience that other death and be cast in a lake that burns with fire and brimstone. And then the third thing is, in verse 6, that they'll be priests of God and of Christ. I think we read some of these passages this morning in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 5. Royal priesthood, holy nation, saints with God, and all those things. Who are those people that are described in 1 Peter 2, verse 5 and in verse 9? Well, it's Christians. So if we stop and think about this, well, this is talking about, you know, what would exist now. All of these take place now in the church. And as a result of that, the thousand-year reign is the reign of Christ in the church now, not in the future. And the thing that kind of I find a little bit disturbing, and that we need to probably think of right here, you might take your Bibles and turn to the Psalms selected. You know, there's a lot of folks who listen to these things and they believe them. And I think about all of the false hope and what people are looking for and thinking is coming and so on. And, you know, you can miss something so easily. They're waiting for this thousand-year reign to come, and what happens then? Well, they'll miss other things. They'll miss other things like obedience to Christ and serving God now and everything because, well, we're looking for this other thing. And we've got our sights set on that, not so much on these things over here. And I think that's a sad thing when you stop to think about it. But what we need to do is to avoid the sensational speculation about Armageddon and the millennium. Some calm study can show that Armageddon has taken place. Jesus is victorious. The battle's been fought. Here's what it is. Judgment has happened. Jesus is Lord. He's victorious over evil. The tempter, the strong man, Satan, has been bound. And the millennium is, we're in it right now. And these are the things that have happened. They're not spectacular events that are going to happen some distant place in the future. Now, by way of invitation, if there's anyone that we can help tonight become a child of God, we'd be glad to do that. If you are a child of God, you need to make correction, we'd be happy to help you with that also. Whatever the case might be, if you're subject to invitation, why don't you come all together? We stand and sing.